This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Good afternoon. It's 5 minutes past one. Thank you, Tim, for the news. An interesting show today. I've got somebody who you've asked to hear from again. So Brett Graham is the man. We met him a little while ago. He was out here to talk MasterChef. And I've had a number of comments from people saying, can you please do Brett Graham again? So I'm going to replay that today. Of course, there is a great big march that is starting right now from the big Treasury office. We'll talk a little bit about that as well. And we're going to talk Hogfest and wine. Well, hello, yes, we are. Good afternoon. It's 6 minutes past one. My name is Pete Dillon. This is Cravings right here on your favourite gay and lesbian radio. It's a big day. 11 years ago when the federal government decided they would change the Marriage Act to exclude those who've been married overseas or indeed exclude same-sex couples. We've now, for 11 years, been marching, and as we speak at the State Library, there is a massive march taking place. That march is, of course, the Equal Love Parade, and it's going to go all the way down to the Treasury Building. If you want to get involved, just jump in your car, get on the train, get on the tram and get into town and be part of it. Between 20 and 25,000 people expected. It's going to be the biggest Equal Love rally that we've seen in some time. And so very shortly I'm going to play a piece of music that's just dedicated to that as well. I'm also going to replay Brett Graham. As I said, we're going to talk to Lauren Mathers about Hogfest. This is an event happening on the 30th of August up at her farm at Bundara Berkshires, and it's all about making stuff with pigs, which is really great fun. And we will be talking as well to Dan Sims about Vin Diemen's and Pinot Palooza and the Women in Wine Awards as well. A lot to get through, including that chat with Brett Graham. For those of you who are not familiar with his name, he is from the Ledbury in London. His restaurant has been as high as number 10 in the world. He's a boy from Newcastle, just north of Sydney, who didn't really know that he wanted to be a chef until he fell into it. So it's a great chat. I'm looking forward to bringing that to you again. But first, as mentioned, it's the Equal Love Parade is happening, and well, I'm hoping that there's a bit of dancing in the streets going on, because well, there should be. It's going to be a great big rally, and I'm really looking forward to popping out there and joining it once I finished here on air.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Your community is our business. Joy 94.9.
Yes, indeed, it is our business. And another thing that is our business is knowing what's going on in the world of food. This is Cravings, of course. My name is Pete Dillon. You are on Joy 94.9. And I'm delighted to welcome my very first guest. She is up on the border of Victoria and New South Wales. And in a couple of weeks, we'll be hosting an event called Hogfest. Lauren Mathers from Bundara Berkshires. Good afternoon.
G'day, Pete. How are you going?
Good, thank you. The weather up there, I'm assuming it's slightly warmer than here.
Oh, look, it's pretty cold, but it's gorgeous today. I just took a picture of the farm where we're having Hogfest, and it's absolutely beautiful. It looks like spring.
Tell us about Hogfest.
Hogfest is it's a rare opportunity to get down on the farm and experience in a very relaxed environment. So we're having sort of just about local food, wine and music.
Yes.
So we've got three bands coming, like a funk band coming locally, a friend who makes wine from Rest Down Wines will be playing his guitar. And then we've got a band coming from over near Albury, Backport Spiders, and they're pretty cool guys. So we've got those three bands all day,
On the Sunday?
Yeah, on the Sunday. So the Saturday I'm doing a workshop with 15 people to butcher a pig and turn it into charcuterie.
Have you filled those spaces? Because I think thought you had one or two left.
They are. No, they're full now. I've actually got there a waiting list, which is pretty exciting.
Excellent. So
yeah.
The big day then is on Sunday where there's a salami competition. Rosa Mitchell's joining you.
Yes, it's going to be so much fun. Rosa's so excited about coming. We've got entries coming in now from all over the place, from Kundrook, Albury, Wodonga, Echuca, Barham, Kundrook, Deniliquin, Bunnaloo, all those big cities in the country.
Thriving populations, each of them as well.
Yeah. It's really tough competition. Salami's one of those rivalry sort of traditional things that you make and you keep all your ingredients very close to your heart. You don't really share them, so... I've had a bloke drop out this morning with some entries and he was very closed shop about his ingredients, but I assured him it was a secret and it wasn't going to be publicised. So it's exciting. And Sophie O'Neill and Stella Gigliotti from Echuca are coming as well to judge. And it's just a fun day, really. And then local food. So we'll be doing some porky bits and then the guys at Rest Down Wine, they have organic beef. They'll be doing some beef dishes and then... The guys at Belmont Biodynamics, they're doing rice and lamb curry.
There's a local food group as well where they'll be having stalls as well, the Red Gum Food Group?
Yeah, so we're all members of the Red Gum Food Group that we started back in 2011. And it's just a bunch of farmers and producers that are keen to get our map on the area for producing great food, which we do.
If people want to know more, Lauren, where can they go to?
Jump on the website at bundarrabarkshires.com.au.
And Berkshire's, we need to tell them, is B-E-R-K.
Yes.
bundarrabarkshires.com.au. All the information is on there for Hogfest 2015. Have a grand time.
Thanks, Pete. Hopefully we'll see you there.
Hopefully you will. I'm looking forward to it. Good on you. Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Lauren Mathers from Bundarra Berkshires. Hogfest 2015. It's going to be a great day. Plenty of music, lots to eat, and lots of good fun. Very shortly, we'll be speaking with Brett Graham. This is Cravings on Joy 94.9. It's currently 1:15.
Joy 94.9 has a huge range of programs available for podcast. In fact, Joy is one of the largest podcasting communities on community radio. If you haven't checked out our podcasting service, you're missing out. Visit joy.org.au, click on the podcast tab, and you'll find a list of Joy programs regularly sharing the best interviews, news, and reviews. There's tens of thousands of hours for you to enjoy, so check it out now. joy.org.au.
Bonjour, I am Gabriel Gatte. You are listening to Cravings with Peter Dillon on Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Yes, indeed you are. Thank you, Gabriel. Just a little while ago, I got to sit down and catch up with Brett Graham. He is from the Ledbury in London. A boy from Newcastle. We had a really remarkable chat, and it's a joy to be able to share that with you today. Here's part one of that discussion with Brett Graham. You are on Cravings on Joy 94.9.
For a chap whose career who started at a fish restaurant on the Newcastle Wharf, he's come a long way as the patron and chef at the Ledbury in Ladbroke Grove in London, voted in 2014 as the world's 10th best restaurant, holding 2 Michelin stars. Brett Graham is that young man, and I'm delighted to welcome him to Cravings. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Doing a week's work experience at Scratchley's on the Wharf in Newcastle at just 15 was a bit of a light bulb moment for you, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one of those times in my life, I suppose. I was a young boy at school and, you know, talking about careers option to your careers teacher in 1990, whatever it was. The first thing on top of a young Newcastle boys list wasn't going to work at a restaurant to be a chef. And I had two ideas. One, I thought I would become a veterinary surgeon. But the idea of, as a 15-year-old, going to work alongside a vet is not one of the things that's accepted as a careers choice. So my second choice was to be a chef. And I went to work at Scratchley's. And after about day two or three, I absolutely loved it. Mm. I found a place where I could see some creativity and some energy and somewhere that was busy and buzzing and... And I fell in love with that sort of adrenaline of service. I think that's where it sort of started, yeah.
Newcastle was hardly the home of haute cuisine at that time of your life. It was pretty hard to find a decent restaurant in Newcastle. How have you evolved from, you know, a boy from Williamtown, which is, you know, pretty much an Air Force base just north of Newcastle, to somebody who now holds position as the number 10 restaurant in the world?
I mean, Haute Cuisine for me when I was 15 years old was Kilpatrick oysters. You know, it was those sort of dishes that I'd never seen. I hadn't been exposed to anything as a young boy. Food for a normal Australian family in those days was just fuel, as well as a way of, you know, a simple thing like a barbecue. So it was a very something that we did as a family with friends and special occasions. Food was important, but it wasn't something, you know, it was nowhere near what it is today in Australia, and the attention to seasonality and ingredients wasn't definitely number one on anybody's list. So, yeah, it was quite different growing up there, different to where it is now. But when I'd started at Scratchley's, you know, even the simple thing of cooking chips or toasted garlic bread, I'd never really done before. So for me, it was a real amazing thing for me to see fish being filleted or, you know, a steak being cooked on a char grill with a pepper sauce. You know, I had never sort of seen how to make a pepper sauce before. Most of those things I've probably seen in a supermarket as a packet sauce, but I'd never actually seen someone make a sauce. Mm. So it was a real eye-opener for me. So that, to me, was as good as food got, I suppose. And it was only years later, while still working at Scratchley's, I remember the guy who's still a great mate of mine, Neil Slater, he bought me a copy of Neil Perry's cookbook. And that's when my eyes opened, and I thought, oh, there's even more to this than I thought. And so that was sort of the real start of my journey.
Liam Tomlin at Bank was a big influence on you. And I read a story where you sort of, the first, you know, couple of days, you slapped him on the back, oh, g'day, mate, how you going, chef? And he blanched and sort of quite, what? Was that a real eye-opener as far as how kitchens operate and the hierarchy in a brigade?
Yeah, I mean, I would probably, you know, they all had a bit of a laugh at me. A lot of the guys in the kitchen at that stage had worked in Europe, so they were seasoned professionals, as I call them, and tough to that sort of level of concentration they needed. But also, they were serious guys. And although I was very energetic and passionate, I didn't have that. Well, I didn't realise that side of discipline is how kitchens run, like you're working in the army. And so, yeah, you're correct. I did slap Lean on the back or try and shake his hand every morning, and it wasn't something that he accepted from the lowest member of the team quite easily. I made lots of comments and stupid things. I actually remember the first day of Bank very, very clearly, being completely overwhelmed, and Lean called on a check, and he said, and he was always speaking bits of French when he called on checks, and one of the things he'd say was, "Sommage, new order," which means new order, I think, and then occasionally he would say Rienavon, which means mains only the dish on the dish. So the first day it comes in, one check comes in, he says, "Sommage, Rienavon, two covers, John Dory and a salmon, whatever." Then the following day, the orders came in, and he calls out "Sommage, Rienavon, two covers." And he was saying on the pass, and I was on the veg section just dressing, I think, a tomato salad or a potatoes. And I went around the front of the pass in the middle of service and said, "Liam, you know that guy Rienavon? He was in for lunch yesterday." To which he responded, "If you say one more stupid thing like that, you're out." Mm. And I had no idea what he was talking about. So I said, "Well, that's not very reasonable. You know, I was trying to help him recognise a regular customer," which I thought was a regular customer. So that's sort of how my life went at Bank. And that was probably ended up in the end being my strength, because I was inquisitive about everything that was happening there. It was an incredibly tough kitchen, and he was an incredibly, incredibly tough man, and probably the guy that I credit with waking me up. Mm. You know, I was a bit dreamy and I wasn't serious, and I'd never seen a serious kitchen before, but he definitely woke me up with a jolt. And, you know, when we got our first Michelin star, he's the first guy I called, because I felt I owed it to him. Mm. Even though he was really tough on me, he's what made a change in my life.
How much do you owe then to Philip Howard at the Square? You went from a Bank in Sydney to London. You worked with Philip at the Square. How much credit do you owe to him for, obviously, setting up? He said he'd never work with another chef until he met you, and that's how the Ledbury started. But how much influence did he have on you as a businessman as much as a chef? Because he's a terrific bloke.
Yeah, there's, you know, cooking, as we all know, and running restaurants is a tough business. And Phil is an absolute gentleman. And in this trade, there are very few and far between as far as the way he behaved, and the way he conducted himself in the kitchen and the way he spoke to his staff. And Phil's one of my best mates and my business partner. I learn a lot from Phil, but about cooking, about tasting things, about delicious food, about flavours. Other people were into techniques. Other people were into, you know, making everything look immaculate. Phil's main focus was, how does it taste? And is it delicious? And is it seasonal? And do my customers want to eat it? Mm. And that's probably the real big thing I took from Phil. And that's been probably the most important thing. Obviously, the motivational energy that I got from Bank was important. But Phil really finished off and helped me guide my palate for years to come. And although this food at the Square and the Ledbury is different, it's got the same slightly classical rooted feeling about it. So a lot of our food crosses over a lot. So we've got a lot of similarities about how we feel about food. So Phil's been a massive influence, and we're absolutely great mates. And that's what's great about a bloke like Phil is we've been in business for 10 years now together. And I've known him for 13 years, and we're very close.
If you could go back to that young man at Scratchley's on the wharf in Newcastle, a little fish cafe restaurant, could you ever have imagined yourself this far down the track as a Michelin-starred restaurateur?
Working at Scratchley's, I mean, I had no idea what Michelin stars were. I didn't even know there was a rating system. In fact, when I was at Bank and I heard them talking about Michelin, I half thought that it was something to do with car tyres, and I wondered why. Because I heard them talking about one star, two star Michelin, and I remember my dad, who was a mechanic who had a shop that sold farm machinery. I remember the Michelin tyres were what they put on some of the tractors, and that's the only reference I could check it to. So my whole career, I've never really thought about the future. I thought about the job at hand at the moment. So when I was at Scratchley's, I just focused on how I could be better at Scratchley's. Mm-hmm. When I was at Bank, I focused on how I could be better at Bank. And when I was at the Square, I focused on how I could be better at the Square. And everything else falls into place. Mm-hmm. I think the fault sometimes with young people or young cooks these days, they think too far ahead. They think about, how am I going to be the head chef? How am I going to be on a television program? How am I going to get a book deal? And what's the quickest way to get there? Mm-hmm. And actually, they shouldn't be thinking about it. They should be thinking, what's the slowest way to get there properly? Mm-hmm. And how can I lay the foundations for a successful career? So I never really had a game plan or a master plan. I still work like that at the Ledbury now. I think about, who are my customers today? Mm-hmm. How are we going to make them have a great time? How are we going to look after them? How are we going to give them great hospitality that they might not have had in a restaurant before? And that's part of the reason we don't do things like social media, like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that sort of stuff. Because we have a job at hand. We're worried about the customers we've already got, not the ones we're trying to get.
Mm. You mentioned Michelin stars. The Ledbury has two. Are you surprised at the level of success that you've achieved? And it sort of leads, I suppose, to another question of, you said you don't look too far ahead, you concentrate on today, but is there the potential for a third Michelin star, do you think, at the Ledbury?
Yeah, Michelin stars, of course, they're what every chef dreams about, I suppose, in many ways. And I'm incredibly proud of the Ledbury having two stars. But when we had one star, there was never a conversation about trying to get two stars. We just did what we did. And I very much try and keep my business focused on the job at hand, like I just said. Like, I really focus about, okay, what are we doing today? What are we doing next week? That's about sort of as far as it goes. We don't try and think about a master plan. We don't try and think about, how can we cut down the amount of covers we have at the Ledbury so we can get three stars. That's not how we work our business. We work our business by thinking, how can we do a really good job? How can we make the business success as well? How can we reward senior people who have looked after us? How can we reward guys who have worked with me for 5 years? How can we hold on to them and make a difference in their life as well? Not just, how can we pay them as minimum as possible, do as least amount of covers as possible. We want to make sure that business works properly and is there to really nurture the talent that we have and people who have helped us along the way. How can we reward them? As far as a third star goes, you know, completely not even an issue at work. We don't talk about that either. We don't have a meeting where I'm to the front of the house, we've got to try and get three stars. We don't compare ourselves to other three-star restaurants. You can spend your whole life wondering and trying to, you know, set yourself a goal, and it can lead to a whole load of disappointment. I think you have to be trying to set yourself realistic goals and goals which you can achieve. And one of the main goal for us is focusing on our hospitality. It's not focusing on something that may never happen.
Mm.
And I think that's the real key thing. You've got to focus on the job at hand every day.
My guest is Brett Graham. He is from the Ledbury in London. It is the number 10 restaurant in the world. He is a boy from regional New South Wales who has really made good.
A diverse sound for a diverse crowd. Joy 94.9.
Hi, I'm Manny Fellel, and you are with Pete Dillon on Cravings on Joy 94.9.
Bring joy to the world. Listen to us everywhere. Download the Joy smartphone app now at joy.org.au.
My guest is Brett Graham. He is from the Ledbury in London. It is the number 10 restaurant in the world. You talked about, in that last question, about, just sort of focusing on today and doing the best we can as far as hospitality. It's an incredibly demanding industry. How do you balance that sort of ridiculous amount of time at work with a personal life? How do you manage a work-life balance? And do you go out and eat at other restaurants, or do you just spend time at home? I know you've got a dog and a beautiful wife. How do you find that balance? What's your little zen space?
I think probably for a normal person, I don't have the balance. You know, that is the thing. I don't have the balance. It's a constant battle with my life to try and get some sort of balance, but I don't have what you would call a balance. 5 nights a week I'm at work. It's incredibly tough on my wife, Natalie. She's very understanding. We've been together for 14 years. Mm-hmm. She has been hugely supportive to what I do. Although she doesn't work at the Ledbury, she's always there for me to help. We live in a place called East Sheen, which is near Richmond Park. Mm-hmm. And my sort of spare time space and my little moment of my week is when I go for a walk with my dog and her in Richmond Park. That's our special place. And that's my sort of peaceful place I like to go. I'm also a bit of an avid gardener. So before work, I can be quite up quite early, or days off, or even late at evening at night, pottering around in the garden doing little bits and pieces. At the moment, we're growing wasabi at home, lots of different Japanese vegetables, different varieties of vegetables that I might be working on at the Ledbury. So it's all interconnected, I suppose. And I'm quite a keen hunter as well, so I do a bit of deer stalking, a bit of bird shooting, all which goes on the menu at the Ledbury. And I enjoy doing it. And again, that's all connected. And it's a really great thing to harvest wild animals that have not lived under any sort of stressful situation, comparing that with some of the modern farming techniques which are very inhumane and doesn't lead to very good quality meat. The harvesting wild meat the way we do it is amazing, and that forms the basis of part of our menu. So that's my little release, I suppose, but everything's sort of connected, so it is a constant battle to get that balance, some sort of balance to work in my life. But you just got to accept that, being a chef is a big part of your life.
You talked about hunting. It's not a popular thing to admit that you like to hunt. But for you, that's all about sustainability and finding ways to use ingredients. Where did that hunting thing come from?
Again, with the connection of the ingredients, often some people might look down and say, oh, this guy goes out and shoots wild animals. What people have to understand is this, is wild animals breed.
Mm.
And if you have a gang of 25 wild deer who were in the most sustainable way foraging by, grazing the land in a really sustainable way, because they're always on the move, so they don't just stand in one spot and concentrate all of their efforts eating the area of one area. They're always concentrated on the move, so they're always browsing the foliage, and it gives it time to, recover after it's been grazed on. So they are the ultimate green way of harvesting meat for the table. What I find fascinating is if you look at the footprint of a deer in terms of carbon footprint, it is basically sort of zero compared to someone who might make a comment about harvesting a wild animal that eats a piece of grain-fed beef. We have a ban at the Ledbury on grain-fed beef. I completely don't agree with the way it's farmed. I think, although there are some guys leading the way in changing the way that grain-fed beef is and supplementing it with grass, you go out to a place that does 300-day grain-fed beef, and these cows are standing on a block of concrete waiting for the next bit of grain to be tipped in. It's not a natural thing that cows should eat. The conversion rate, I believe, is about 12 to 13 kilograms of grain to 1 kilogram of beef. I mean, that's... We can't continue to...
The water that goes with it.
The water, everything. And if you look at the transportation of the grain to the farm, like, if you trace it all the way back, how can somebody keep a straight face when they talk about sustainability? You know, and there's no point in doing things like recycling your waste from your restaurant if you're piling your customers full of grain-fed beef. Mm-hmm. And so we have rules in place at the Ledbury, a complete ban on grain-fed beef. The only animals we're allowed to use are only native breeds that live outdoors. Mm-hmm. So they don't get put in the shed in winter. So they're native breeds that are used to living in extreme conditions in places like Cumbria, where it's very unforgiving. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they grow slower, and therefore they taste better. Mm-hmm. We also are conscious about the way we eat meat. Me, for one, at home, quite often at home, I will not eat any meat at all. I'll eat vegetable-based food a lot. And then when I go out for dinner to a good restaurant, or I'll buy a fantastic piece of grass-fed beef, the very best, and I eat a lot less meat than I used to, but I'll eat the best grass-fed beef from or lamb from the best breeders, from the best animals. And I think that's the way we need to sort of approach this situation that's coming along. I was watching a documentary a couple of weeks ago, and they were saying if China... The eating habits of China is changing. If they eat the same amount of meat as Americans do, the world can't produce enough meat. Mm. And these are things we have to look at. And it comes back to that harvesting of a wild animal. I think it's really going to be a real key thing here. I mean, in Australia, in my opinion, I think you guys should be eating more kangaroo. Mm. You know, you should be eating a lot more of it. I know people are a bit weird about eating an animal off the coat of arms, maybe still, but everybody should be eating kangaroo. Mm. Every barbecue should have kangaroo on there. We should relieve the pressure from the intensive farming that happens and try to use some of those native ingredients. They should be harvested and managed. And that's where I think the future is with ingredients like that.
I think you could say similarly for a feral camel problem that we've got in the country, and there are abattoirs now set up and you can buy camel prosciutto and that sort of thing, which sort of leads me quite diversely to unusual ingredients. You like unusual ingredients. How much influence is there? How much of that Australian boy, that you know, Novocastrian, is in the menu and the food in the Ledbury, or is there none at all?
Well, I think the influence from being a young boy from Newcastle, or actually let's talk about young people from Australia, because my kitchen is made up of quite a lot of them. Unusual ingredients. You know, when I arrived in England, I was so young, 20, 21 years old. I hadn't formed a repertoire of ingredients. I hadn't been a head chef or a sous chef, so I didn't have any real specific ideas of how my style was going to develop. So I'm always on the lookout for a different cut of meat, an underutilized part of an underutilized vegetable, working with farmers who maybe have an excess of something that they need to use, an ingredient that might be fabulous. Like, I went to a farm recently and I've got a new dish on at the moment, which is with white beetroots baked in clay, and it's seasoned with dried mackerel. Mm. So we use the trimmings and we dehydrate them every day to use that to season the vegetable rather than the other way around. Mm. So we're always looking at different techniques and how we can utilize trimmings. We just started stopping using things like bonito, which is an imported ingredient, obviously, which is ultimately comes from bonito and the tuna family, and mm-hmm. and it's a very precious resource. So now we're starting to smoke the bones from the mackerel to replace the flavour in a dressing that we would have in the past used bonito. So that's where our real focus is at the moment. What's great about Australians is the kitchen is made up, the backbone of our kitchen at times is made up of young Australian guys and girls. They've got a fantastic attitude. You know, Greg Austin, who's my most senior chef there, is my head chef. He is an absolutely fantastic cook and a great guy. Mm. He's from Foster, and he arrived 5.5 years ago at the Ledbury. Young guy, got his head down and just went for it. Mm. And you know what speaks, what I think makes a great chef or a great cook who is part of a team, is somebody who's willing to have a go. And Aussies are really good at that. They sort of get on with the job. They're not worried about, they don't let other things, outside things, upset them too much. It's like, right, this is a job at hand. This is what we're going to do. And that's what I love about Australians. Mm-hmm. And so that's the energy we have in the kitchen. We have that real Australian, let's have a go. Let's go the extra mile. Let's try harder. And that's what makes it a special little team we've got in the kitchen.
Why MasterChef Australia?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very fair question. I think the last time I actually filmed was probably, I did a television filming of any type was 4 or 5 years ago. And Matt had asked me a few times, come over and film MasterChef Australia. I'm not going to do that. And I've got nothing against television. It's just that my focus is the restaurant. Mm. And I need to make sure that we've talked about that balance thing before, that I don't try and do too many things that take my focus on what I'm trying to be good at.
Mm.
And I think sometimes in people's careers, they go too early. They go too quick. We've got to take our time here. We've got to be in it for the long game. We're not there to try and overexpose the library too quickly.
Mm.
I enjoy cooking. You know, I know that sounds crazy, but, you know, I'm a cook and I'm still on the road to like everybody else. I'm not the executive chef. I'm not the restaurateur. You know, I'm a cook like everybody else in the kitchen, and I'm part of that team. And that's what I enjoy doing, being part of that team. Every morning by 9 o'clock, we're having a meeting, and I'm running the meeting, talking about the menu, talking to individual people about what's expected of them for that day, things we want to change, things we want to do. And I'm very much hands-on, and that's how I want to remain, and that's what I enjoy. And doing television or doing other things that take my focus away from that is not my number one priority. However, the MasterChef thing, hugely respected program. I know the guys who do the production of it are absolute professionals, and that's probably what attracted me to it. I thought, you know what, if I'm going to do something once in 4 or 5 years, I'm going to try and do the best program I can.
Do you think the program has made young people, and if I go back to the very first series of MasterChef 5 or 6 years ago, has the program made young people more aware of food, and therefore are there more young people who are thinking that cooking for a living is an absolute option rather than being a vet or a policeman?
Yeah, I think you know, with anything that's been as successful as MasterChef, there's always an upside and a downside, and with a program like MasterChef, the upside is far outweighs any sort of downside it might do. But it really has. If you look at the career of a chef, or for that instance, anyone who runs a restaurant, it's changed a lot in terms of how it's respected in the general public's eyes. I think as a young boy growing up in Newcastle, you think that it's not really on top of some of the list of priorities of people. It wouldn't be a job that people say, oh, my son's a chef, and be proud to sort of say it 15 years ago. Mm. Now people are very proud to say their son or daughter's a chef or runs a restaurant or is a waiter or whatever. And they used to be sort of jobs working in kitchens in front of house that you did while you were going to university. And now it's an absolute profession. And these guys, a lot of these guys, they've become sort of, I suppose, minor and major celebrities through cooking.
What's the message you're leaving with the MasterChef contestants from this series? What's that? I don't want to use the word legacy because that is such a big word, but what's the message you're leaving with them as you sort of walk out of the kitchen and the challenge is finished? What do you want them to take away from your visit to MasterChef as compared to, you know, Marco Pierre White's or Marcus Waring's or any of those?
Yeah, one of the things I tried to impress on them yesterday was, you know, we're at the sharp end of the competition here, and they're guys who I was really impressed by their level of skill, actually. I thought that they reminded me of young professionals rather than young amateurs. They've been very well trained. They've had a lot of focus and energy put on them by both the chefs who are running the competition and the production guys. They've put a lot of work into these guys. So it's a really professionally run operation. So these guys are coming out of that competition in the next couple of weeks really with really sharp skills, and the journey of what I could see yesterday of how they started to where they are now is a massive difference, huge difference from a group of young people who just viewed cooking as a passion, a part-time passion, to people who are focused on going to make it their career. And I tried to impress on them yesterday that the most important thing is tasting what you eat. Tasting what you cook and eat, you know, and think about food and think about a dish as a whole, rather than being too focused at this stage on their career in techniques and in fancy things that don't make a difference to the taste of the dish.
I can't let you go without asking a question that I ask every chef that I meet from around the world. We all have a secret shame. and you know, you get home from a service, it's 1 o'clock in the morning, you don't want to cook, you haven't eaten at work, you're hungry, what's that thing that you will reach for that you know is the opposite end of what you do, that is rubbish, but you just want to eat something? What is that?
Yeah, actually, you know, it very rarely happens that I get home from work, and apart from eating a dry piece of sourdough toast, as I'm getting older, I can't eat as much as I used to when I was a young boy. But if I was going to have one naughty thing at the end of a hard service, because late night restaurants in London don't sort of exist as much as they probably do here, it's not a sort of thing to do. You know, if when I was living in Sydney, it would be go to Golden Century and eat XO Pippies or something like that. Mm-hmm. If I was going to cook something at home and it was naughty and bad, it would probably be a fish finger sandwich with really shit white bread, yes, with iceberg lettuce and cold tomato sauce out of the fridge.
Excellent. Excellent. That is gold. I love it. I've had toasted grilled cheese sandwiches is very frequent. Baked beans out of a can, quite possibly eaten cold. I think Marco Pierre White was all about at McDonald's if he had his daughter with him. There have been so many of those answers. I've got to compile them all somehow. Brett Graham, it's been a delight to catch up with you. It's been a few years since I saw you. It's great to have you on the program. And one final question, I can't not ask this question. Is there any plan in the distant future to bring Natalie and the dog back to Australia and resettle here and bring something from what you've developed over these years at the Ledbury back to Australia?
I'm not sure, actually. It's a question that's been sort of playing over. I mean, I love Australia. Mm-hmm. I love Australia. I love Australians. This is my heritage, where I'm from. My life at the moment is very much focused on the centre of my universe, which happens to be Notting Hill and my house in East Sheen. And that's about as far as it goes at the moment. I would never say never. Mm-hmm. I think this would be a fantastic place, at worst, to retire. Mm-hmm. But I think at the moment, I'm focused on there. But I would never say I'd never do, you know, a restaurant in Australia would never be out of the question. Mm. 100%, but at the moment there's no plans.
If only my listeners could see your face as you were talking about that, because I think it gave away a lot more than you're willing to. But great to see you and have a safe journey back to the UK, and we look forward to catching up with you when you're back next.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Anna De Silva, and you're listening to Cravings with Pete Dillon on Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
We've just loaded a heap of Joy podcasts to our website. Head to joy.org.au now to hear Dylan of Counterculture keeping himself busy interviewing musicians Holly J, Nick Kennedy and Dylan Lewinsky, and Chris and Cam of the CNC Drive Factory chatting to Malcolm and Tony of the US group MKTO. I don't know what that means. And Gordon speaking to Nicole of Red Cross to find out all that there is to know about the Big Cake Bake. Head to the Joy website now or later. It's up to you. Podcasts where you want them, when you want them, at joy.au. Sorry, org.au/podcasts. Now, there is a wine tour happening, formerly known as, I think, Tasmanian Unbottled, which is going around the country. The person behind that is our old buddy Dan Sims. He joins me on the phone because, I tell you what, there is nobody earning more frequent flyer points than this man right this minute. G'day, mate. How are you going?
G'day, Pete. How are you going, mate?
You must be racking up frequent fly miles. You just finished the Pinot Palooza tour right around Australia.
Yeah. So we're in Perth a couple of weeks ago, Adelaide last week, and then Melbourne this week, Brizzy for Vin Diemen next week, and then we're in Sydney.
So what is Vin Diemen?
Vin Diemen is, in short, a celebration of all things Tasmania, especially wine. That would probably be the best way to explain it. So it's the event formerly known as Tas Unbottled.
Yep.
But what we're sort of doing this year is, like, Wine Tasmania came to us and said, look, we sort of want to introduce a bit of food. So we thought, awesome, that sounds great. So we've
starting with salmon.
Well, we absolutely. So we've got salmon. Dave Moyle's coming up from Franklin. He's working with the guys from Burn City Smokers. So we're really sort of upping the food side of things. We've got oysters. We've got a great little produce store. So we've got some Grandview cheese, Huon salmon, some other little bits and pieces there as well. And really, it's just a really good day, to chance to get to see Tassie all in the one spot. Like, and there's a lot of things that, I mean, with Tasmania, there's not often that actually get to the mainland.
Indeed, so, and if we think about wine from Tasmania, you can't go past Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and probably some Riesling, and probably some of Australia's best sparkling wines come from
Tassie. Totally. Well, absolutely, hands down, the best sparkling coming out of Australia at the moment is from Tasmania, and really, it is absolutely amazing. So we've got, you know, Gans, Piri, and Aris there tomorrow, which is awesome. So it's and also Pinot Noir, as you said, like Pinot is huge. In fact, 40% of all the vines planted in Tasmania are Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. So it makes complete sense that, you know, they've got such a strong, you know, example of Pinot. And I think Tassie wines in general are really sort of evolving in style, which is amazing.
One of the other things I think that is important that's coming out of Tasmania is some boutique or artisan distilleries, where Lark, I guess, is not as small, but there's cider and all sorts of things coming out of Tassie as well that are fantastic.
Well, exactly. You know, we've got Frank Cider, Willie Smith, and Lark actually having their gin. So, I mean, these are all sort of local guys. So we're not just, you know, having just wine. As I said, you know, there's amazing wine, but there's the whole thing. I mean, Tassie, it's you know, it's beautiful now. You know,
yes.
It's really stunning.
It is a stunning place in the world. Now, this is happening tomorrow in North Melbourne. Are there still tickets available?
There are tickets available. It's getting pretty tight, so we're anticipating, you know, in excess of around 500 people tomorrow. But it's a really lovely day. So I get there about 11 o'clock. You know, it's 11 till 6. So I can sort of spend the whole afternoon cruising around,
sipping,
you know, tasting,
and
sampling and all that. And of course, you get a wine glass on arrival. You get a beautiful little plum wine glass to taste from and take home with you.
Excellent.
Awesome. And, but, yeah, just cruising along through and having a bit of fun.
Nothing like a bit of Terps and Tucker in North Melbourne on Sunday. So can people go to bottleshotconcepts.com.au?
No, best way is they just go to vindemon.com and it's all there.
So V-I-N-D-I-E-M-E-N, vindemon.com, and yep. Everything is on there. Fantastic. Now, something else that's come to my attention this week, and I will be quoting your mate and mine, Claire Berda. The Fabulous Ladies Wine Society has launched the Australian Women in Wine Awards. And it's winemakers, viticulturists, owners, operators, and champions of change. Claire Bird has raised a really valuable point here, and I want to quote her because she said I could. What about all the amazing women who work in sales, distribution, research, wine science, marketing comms, cellar door operations, and educators, journalists, and SOMs? Do you think the Fabulous Ladies Wine Society has got it right?
Look, I think it's an attempt at creating attention to a real gender gap when it comes in the wine industry. And as a first time round, certainly, you know, of course, perhaps it should actually include all those people. And I tend to agree with Claire that you would love to have, I mean, we should have like more sort of inclusive side. But I think for a first attempt, I think, you know, it's a funny one, Pete, because it's like, no, we shouldn't have to do this. And I have a frustration with that. It's like, should we do that? No, we shouldn't actually have to do it. It's, I mean, it's ridiculous that we actually have to have awards for this. But at the same time, we need to draw attention to the fact that there is a major, you know, gender gap in terms of, you know, or lack of diversity within the wine industry.
I was having a chat to Kate Goodman about a week ago, and she was saying the same thing. You know, there was a glass ceiling, and it was people like Vanya Cullen and those women and older women who...
Sorry, mate.
That's all right. I assume you're bumping in for the event. People who are have broken that glass ceiling, and women are more prominent in wine. But is there still a way to go, do you think, to your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's changing, definitely. But just because, you know, there's, say, one, you know, two women head of a national wine show does not mean that everyone gets to stop and pat each other on the back and move on. Like, you know, we need to talk about diversity in wine, and that's not gender, that's race, that's, you know, sexuality, that's everything, you know.
We still haven't found our gay winemaker, mate.
Well, you know, there's these things, like, we need to, hey, I know you're hunting, mate, so...
Oh, I've been looking for a long time, and Kate gave me a couple of hints, but, you know, the jury's out on a couple of them, so we've got to leave it go.
But look, I think, you know, it is. I mean, two minds. It's, you know, people say, you know, is having a women in wine competition sexist? You know, well, not necessarily, but then it's, you know, you have to draw attention to it. So, yeah, it's a frustration that we have to do it, but I think because there is such a lack of diversity within the wine industry, that we need to. you know. And just because, people don't, like, I don't see, you know, a difference, you know, race, gender, colour, creed, sexuality, doesn't mean that there's not an issue, you know, because I don't feel that way. I don't see a difference. I don't really care. Like, doesn't matter who you are. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's...
And look, it's been known for historically, and I can say this, you probably can't, it has always been a very male-dominated industry. Both
it is.
The viticulturalists, the winemakers, the heads of companies predominantly have been men.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, it is predominantly male, but it is changing, you know. But there's also, like, a culture that comes with it, and the sort of the casual, you know, sexism. And I've been at wine shows, and I've heard things, and I go... You can't say that. Like, it's just, you can't. Like, it's just not right.
Just not appropriate.
It's not appropriate, and it's just, it's done casually in a way, it's just a joke.
Yeah, it is.
It's not a joke.
No, well, it's...
And, you know...
It's a difficult thing to face, mate. It's always good. When you stop travelling, when you've got 5 minutes and you can sit down in this studio, come in and talk to me. There's a lot happening in the wine industry that can always keep us talking through a whole show.
Yeah.
So we'll find you. And by the way, I think that was they were calling out to your chicken Kiev is ready at the bistro.
Would you believe I'm in the middle of, like, Woolworths trying to get some last minute stuff for tomorrow? So, you know, forgive me.
There is a free plug if ever there was one, mate. Good to talk to you.
All right, mate.
Enjoy the rest of your Woolies shopping, and we'll talk soon. That's Dan Sims. He is, of course, from Bottle Shot Concepts. Vindemen, VINDIEMEN.com is the website to go and see if you want to have a bit of a wander through North Melbourne tomorrow afternoon and taste the best of Tasmania on the plate and, of course, in the glass. They do make the finest sparklings in the country, and they do make some pretty good reds and whites as well, and it's going to be a great day. It's almost time for me to give you a fond farewell, and I'll go and join the marriage equality rally that is happening in the street as we speak. It's been a pleasure having your company this afternoon. I'll be back next week, another fun-filled show, of course. Mark and Russ are about to take you travelling on the Escape Pod. It's going to be another cracking show, so I'll hand you over to them very shortly. Again, thank you to our program support team and the podcasting team, to Peter, who is my podcaster. All of our podcasts should be up to date this afternoon, and you can catch up with any episodes that you fail to miss of the show. Just download them, and you can listen at your leisure. Have a listen in the car, perhaps. It's been good to have your company again. I'm Pete Dillon. I look forward to joining you again next week. Until then, wishing you a very, very pleasant afternoon, and... I hope to see you down at the rally. This has been Cravings on your favourite gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.